Checking on the Arts is made possible by the Orpheum Theater and by Memphis College of Art. The Paul and Linnea Burt Classic Accent Series with the Memphis Symphony continues this Sunday at GPAC with Beethoven's Second and some other great things on the program. Memphis Symphony Principal Conductor Robert Moody has joined us along with guest mezzo-soprano Elizabeth Bishop. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for making it, Bob.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
This is a wonderful-looking program. We're going to talk with Elizabeth in just a moment about this. These incredible songs that she's going to be singing. But you're starting off with more Stravinsky. This is like Stravinsky month for you.
Yes.
You just did Petrushka.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I will tell you, there was no master plan in this. Sometimes I wish I could say that I had some great overarching thought, but it so happened that we did Petrushka last week on the Masterwork series and now Pulcinella this week. And the two of them, in some ways, have a lot of similarities. First of all, they're both about puppets.
Right.
You know, Petrushka, right. Petrushka to Russia is what Pulcinella, and eventually Pulcinella's cousin, Pinocchio, is to Italian lore. So it's that story set to ballet. I think the interesting thing about Pulcinella is that it came just near the end of the First World War. And so you think about Stravinsky writing in 1910, 1911, 1913. All of these works were huge, you know, just Petrushka and then the Rite of Spring, so many human beings on stage, large, large forces. Pulcinella is the opposite, small forces. Mm-hmm. And this is when Stravinsky, at that time in his life, moved into what we think of as his neoclassical period. It's
right.
The moment in which he's not just reducing forces, but thinking of a different era. But also, think about it. It's World War I.
Right.
This is why he wrote L'Histoire des Soldats at that time. All of these works that call for small forces, because that's what he had. He had small forces. And the events of World War I basically forced him into a new way of thinking. So for people who think of the Rite of Spring and the riots that it caused, for example, Pulcinella could not be further afield. At the end of the day, it's sort of the spikiness of Stravinsky, but mostly it's Pergolesi. Mostly it's
right.
This wonderful Baroque, you know, early classical, late Baroque feeling. It happens to be one of the first pieces I ever conducted. And so I think I have a really like deep sentimental feeling for the work as well. So we open the concert with Pulcinella. It's a suite of a number of tunes. It's set into seven sections, and some of those are even kind of subdivided a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it really just feels like a fantastic Baroque suite, and every now and then your ear will hear something kind of funky, and that's the Stravinsky early 20th century part.
Exactly. And as you said, you are doing the suite. It is a complete ballet, but Stravinsky actually himself did several suites.
Correct.
From this and at various periods in his life.
And sort of connecting us to the next piece on the program, the Cantaloupe, some of the suites and the ballet do include vocalists. So
right.
It has a number of beautiful works for singers as well.
Yeah. And then, as you said, we're going to continue with Joseph Cantaloube's Songs of the Auvergne with Elizabeth Bishop, who is founder and head of the Potomac Vocal Institute, frequent guest of major opera companies and orchestras throughout the United States and overseas, also a widely respected teacher and advocate for music education. She won the Metropolitan National Opera Council auditions in 1993 and made her Met debut the following year and has since become a regular there. Also has a close association with her home company, Washington National Opera, and is a member of San Francisco's Merolo program and an Adler Fella, and has sung a variety of roles for San Francisco Opera, and this just goes on and on and on, but we're going to stop now. Welcome.
You should really stop now and let me leave. That was impressive.
Thanks, thanks for coming in.
Before I talk and ruin it all.
these pieces that you're going to do, the Joseph Cantaloube Songs of the Auvergne, they're just gorgeous,
beautiful.
Tell us about them.
Well, I had mentioned that and Bob called and said, you know, can you do these pieces? And I'm like, sure. And I listened, I've never heard of them before.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
This is becoming a theme for us.
This is becoming a theme for us. So I'd never heard them. And I went to listen, and I'm like, holy smoke, boy has some taste. These are nice pieces.
Yeah.
And it's really funny because the texts are, They're like any sort of folk song. They make very little sense to us. They don't speak to us
right.
The way the music speaks to us. But it's so you hear these things and they're so lush and they're so pastoral and so large, and then when it comes down to what he collected, because Cantaloupe was also a musicologist and he grew up in the Auvergne, these were things that, you know, these little 3 and 4 lines of text meant the world to him because it evoked so much history, so much memory. You know, he actually said, writing about these songs, that that folk music approaches the highest level of art, but not of form. And it's actually true. It's, you know, it's human emotion, simple human emotion writ large.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And, you know, we did this, and it's interesting. It didn't cross my mind until you just said that, that one thing we should let the cat out of the bag is that not only does Elizabeth Bishop have all the accolades that you just gave her, in the first grade, she was a Jonquil in the first grade spring play, and I was the MC of that same play.
We lived about a mile apart for 22 years.
Yes, we've been friends since we were 6.
Yes.
So
So we grew up egging each other on, and I won't even.
And, yeah. And so
we're on the radio,
and
so I can't
like
keep going.
Like Cantaloupe, we like these words. I was just thinking, we recall sort of you know, when you know someone since you're 6 years old, you can very easily say something like, you know, remember the place where we used to meet, you know, out behind Duncan Chapel Elementary School, and that only means something to us.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know,
that place where we did the thing.
The thing
correct.
That
correct.
Exactly right.
Elizabeth, you are actually
you can call me Betsy.
Betsy, you have a little challenge in this because it is in a language that very few people know. It is in Occitan.
It's in Occitan. Occitan actually, you know, you think, oh my heavens, that must be a completely dead language. It's Latin, and it's not. It's actually spoken still as a dialect, and does not show any signs of really stopping. It's just never spread.
Right.
So it's still very contained in the region. But yeah, and it is a nightmare trying to figure out, you know, which way to go, and trying to learn to sing in this was, like I said, I had to convince myself that it was Portuguese because I've been decades of work in French. And if you look at this with your French brain on, your French filters, you can't sing it because it's all weird. You have to say the ends of the words and the you split the vowel clusters and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't have the same feel. It's not as smooth as singing French. It's punchier.
Yeah.
And so it's a sort of a mashup of Spanish and French, and it's Languedoc.
Yeah, yeah. So. Apparently closely related to Catalan.
Yes, very,
yeah,
very.
Yeah, and it's still spoken, as you mentioned, in that region, the Auvergne, which is actually sort of in slightly south-central France.
Yeah.
And it
used to be the Aquitaine.
There you go.
There you go.
Well, they're gorgeous songs. A couple of them, there's one I think called The Shepherd's Call or something like that, and then another one, have actually become popular, used in some commercials and some things like that.
And the last two pieces of the cycle we're doing now were used in Henry V, I believe.
Oh, that's right.
I believe.
Yeah,
and so it was actually part of that. But yeah, they've become, but it's because they're so beautiful.
Yeah.
They're easily approachable, and you'll enjoy every second of listening to it. And so it becomes something very good to use for mass appeal.
There you go.
And the orchestration is brilliant. We discovered in sort of learning this piece that there are a number of orchestrations.
Hmm.
In fact, at one moment, Betsy and I were kind of comparing recordings, and as I listened to one that she recommended, I had a moment of panic. I thought, I'm looking at my score and seeing an English horn playing, but on the recording hearing a viola, and I thought, oh gosh, are we looking at two different orchestrations? It just turns out that there are a fair amount, and the orchestration we're using is especially kind to the way that it creates orchestral colors. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, the woodwinds especially. Oboe, English horn, flute, bassoon, just some really amazing colors sort of just meld perfectly with the human voice.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really lovely.
We're talking about the second concert in the Paul and Linnea Burt Classic Accents series. It is this Sunday at 2:30 p.m. at GPAC. And get your tickets at 537-2525 or memphissymphony.org. Robert Moody and Elizabeth Bishop here with me this morning. You're going to finish up with more Beethoven, the Symphony Number 2.
Yep.
Why that particular choice? It's an interesting choice. It sort of marks the end of his early period. And
correct, and that's really one of the things I was thinking of. This is my second Beethoven with Memphis Symphony. We did the 5th, And the fifth is, you know, first of all, it's the most famous four notes in the entire world. But it's really Beethoven sort of right just, you know, in the lushness of the – right in the middle of him basically discovering romanticism and sort of taking on an entirely new language. The second – often I've said to people that Beethoven's second – you could call Beethoven first and second symphonies Mozart symphonies 42 and 43 because they are a natural sort of evolution of what happened at this moment. And the Beethoven second symphony, I think specifically – I know I just said Mozart, but I also have a – feeling the more I pay attention to the work of how much I think he's making an homage to his teacher Haydn. You know, we think Beethoven and Mozart met. There's a great story that they did indeed meet, and Mozart apparently said to Constanze, "You know, keep your eye on this young man." I hope it's a true story.
Yeah.
We're not quite sure, but I hope it's a true story. We know that Beethoven not only met Haydn but studied with him for a long time,
and
by 1800, 1801, when he's writing this symphony, Haydn is quite an old man. He lived a few years longer, but at this point, Haydn is really only able to go out in public a very few times. Right around this time, there was a concert for Haydn, and Beethoven was one of the people in charge of getting him out, and actually it was all his music, but he was so ill that he could only stay for a portion of the concert. So I think of this second as like Beethoven's, it's the height of the classical era. And because right after this comes the third, comes Eroica, suddenly, you know, people are sort of turned on their ear about what's happening. Perfect classical work, four movements. It follows the patterns, and it also does some specific things, especially with fermata, with holding chords in the final movement that for me are very much kind of a nod to Haydn. The other thing I think that's really fascinating about the symphony, it's 1800, 1801. It's exactly when he was living in a little suburb of Vienna called Heiligenstadt.
Right.
This is right when he, for the first time, admits to someone that he's losing his hearing.
Yeah.
He writes a letter to his brothers, and the famous Heiligenstadt Testament, and really poor. If anyone hasn't read it, if you want to come on Sunday, I would also say read this because he just pours his heart out. It's heartbreaking to read this musician saying that I should have this sense in me, hearing, that should be more highly developed than any other human as a musician, and it's leaving me. So to know that that's happening in his life at the same time that he's writing this incredible, sort of perfect classical, most positive, most happy piece of music, it's fascinating. This is we rehearsed last night, and this is a great concert, I have to say. Just the Stravinsky, Cantaloupe, Beethoven, I think the pairings are fantastic.
I'm the fluffy filling in the middle.
No, you are. When you say the thing about there, so she's right about the text. One of the most gorgeous movements of the Cantaloupe. She's actually saying, you know, you and me, my friend, we're going to go
buy a cow.
And I'll get the cow, but you get the cow's horns. So it's,
I know.
Don't get too deep into the philosophical meaning of these texts. Just enjoy the beauty.
Well, it's a wonderful looking concert. Pulcinella, the Songs from the Auvergne, and the Beethoven Symphony No. 2 this Sunday at 2:30 p.m. at Germantown Performing Arts Center, the Memphis Symphony, Paul and Leobert Classic Accent Series. Get your tickets now, 537-2525 or memphissymphony.org. Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Moody, my guests today. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks a lot.
Checking on the Arts is made possible by contributing listeners and by the Orpheum Theater presenting The Bodyguard, the musical, starring Deborah Cox, January 24th through 29th. Based on the smash hit film, The Bodyguard features classic Whitney Houston songs, including Queen of the Night, I Want to Dance with Somebody, and I Will Always Love You. More information at orpheum-memphis.com, and by Memphis College of Art presenting Whole Being, works by Sheila Bailey, on view through January 26th in the Rust Hall Alumni Gallery, 1930 Poplar, with a special reception on Friday, January 20th. That's tomorrow. Additional information at mca.edu. Memphis College of Art, they make art work.